This is Five Live Sport with Eleanor Oldroyd.
Good evening and welcome to Bespoke as part of the BBC's Women's Sports Week. It is a female-only show tonight. So, yes, they've let me in and they may allow Chris Boardman on a little later, but there was no room for Rob Hales this evening. Instead, his seat is being kept warm by cycling journalist and presenter Rebecca Charlton. Good evening, Rebecca.
Good evening, OJ. Thanks for having me on tonight.
Thank you very much for coming. Now, of all the amazing top female cyclists you've interviewed over the years, and I would guess there's a few, who's been your favourite and why?
Good question to start with. Now, Laura Trott's someone that I chat to a lot after a lot of different races, and she's not only always really good fun, but she's raced her whole life since she was so small that she's got so much insight, so she's a top pick for me.
Name dropper. From Bristol, we're joined by women's cycling aficionado and blocker Sarah Connolly. Good evening, Sarah.
Good evening.
Good evening. What's been the most inspirational event of all the events you've covered? What's been the most inspirational?
Without doubt, the Friends Life Women's Tour last year. Amazing Olympic-level crowd showing that people in Britain just love getting the chance to see cycling, and especially women's cycling. It was wonderful.
Plus, we have the lady whose job it is to get a million more women cycling by 2020. It's British Cycling's Natalie Justice. Natalie, good evening.
Good evening. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for coming on. Are you well on the way to that number?
We're getting there now, and we're actually I can't say too much about it because we're releasing some information tomorrow, but it is quite exciting, and we're, you know, there is some real great news stories coming out of that.
I'll be working on you later for a scoop, you know that, don't you?
Yes. So
over the next hour we'll talk to Olympic and world champion Danny King, world downhill mountain bike champion Rachel Atherton has put me through my paces, and we'll talk to a former Olympian and now cycling campaigner. Amongst other things, that person is the aforementioned Chris Boardman. If you want to join the conversation, we would love to hear from you. 85058 is the text line number, at BBC5Live if you want to get in touch on Twitter. So let's get this show going. So the success achieved by Great Britain's female track cyclists has been widely celebrated since the Beijing Olympics in 2008. But whereas the men's road cycling has gone from strength to strength, where are we in terms of women's cycling? Sarah, let's start with you. Would you say that women's road cycling is in a good place?
Yeah, it's in a good place and it's getting better all the time. I mean, when I started writing about this 5 years ago, you couldn't hardly see any races. And this year, it's amazing. There's live stage races, live day races. This weekend, we've got two Women's World Cups streamed live on the internet.
And that's great. And I think normally most people would think there's a bit of doom and gloom around women cycling on the road. Rebecca, is that wrong for people to see the doom and gloom?
I don't think it's necessary. Wrong, but I think the sport's come so far that it is really, really positive in my view anyway at the moment. I mean, I was at the Croydon round of the Tour Series on Tuesday and there were 72 females on that start line. And I mean, just such a brilliant calibre. And where that's come from, when I was a youth rider, I was actually the only girl to race in with the boys, ultimately at the track championships the first year that Manchester Velodrome opened. And from that to what I see now is just such a positive contrast.
Well, it's great to know there's positive stuff happening. Let's start with the road race events, because you mentioned events. For the men, we know the major ones like the Tour de France, the Giro, the Classics. What is, Natalie, the major road race event for women?
I mean, there's many of them, and I'm sure Sarah will kind of talk quite a lot about it. But a big one for us, obviously, last year was the Women's Tour. I mean, that was just absolutely phenomenal to, you know, to get the world's top riders riding here, the spectator support, and everything we kind of got from that in terms of getting people interested was just phenomenal, really.
Sarah, how big was it? How big was that event? Because I remember covering it at the time, and it was humongous.
It's amazing. The phrase that everyone said all the time was raising the bar. Riders said they'd never seen anything like it outside the Olympics. Teams were so impressed. And Sweet Spot, who organised it, put in so much work. They got every single local school out. And they're saying about this year's race, the Aviva Women's Tour, 17th to 21st of June, they reckon they're going to have 25,000 kids roadside over the course of the race.
That's a great thing. I mean, is that what needs to happen for women's cycling? Is that what needs to happen? They need to get kids out there and show the positive aspects of seeing these women race around these courses.
Yeah, I mean, it's wonderful. I mean, the best thing about it was it wasn't just aiming at young girls, because you had young boys who were just going crazy to meet Danny King and Laura Trott and really, really inspired. And you know that there's going to be some small children out there that are going to go on to be racing stars who are going to say, yeah, I got interested when I was roadside, or I got interested when I saw it on TV. It's just fantastic.
So let's talk about La Course, which was history sort of in the making as the women's race at the Tour de France. Was it a success, Rebecca?
I think so, and I know that there's been a lot of talk around this, and it's a very interesting one because, of course, we all want to see Grand Tours for the women. We want to see that strength of racing. But, of course, you know, you've still got a lot of women. You know, if you look at the peloton in the UK, a lot of these women are still holding down full-time jobs whilst they're also trying to run off and get the racing in as well. And so I think, you know, there's a lot of things behind the scenes that need to happen to get that race field that's strong enough to get, you know, a race like the Women's Tour to get to where we perhaps want to see it internationally.
Well, because I remember talking to Lizzie Armistead just before the Tour de France left from Yorkshire, and she was not upset about it, but she was angry about the fact La Course was just a circuit race. She was like, I am strong enough and I want to ride, and there is a field that can ride a full Tour de France. Why is that not happening then, Rebecca?
Again, I think it's complicated, and I think if you ask a few of the different girls at that sort of level what they think, there will be quite a few differences in opinion. I mean, I was speaking to Marianne Vos about it. I know that Lizzie Armistead came out with that, and I completely agree with her. You know, it was a shame. Everyone thought it was a shame, and riders like Lizzie and Marianne, you know, they are going to be able to go on to ride a race like that and represent cycling so, so well. But I think perhaps, you know, at a tier below, you haven't got the field there, or at least in a lot of people's opinion, you haven't, until you can really bring all the field up to that level that you've really got at the heights that they're at.
So, Sarah, do you agree with that? Is it the fact that there's not a quality enough field to race something like a full Tour de France?
I know, I don't agree. Emma Pooley said, well, right now, of course, you wouldn't be able to, because at the moment they're training for races where most races are kept by the UCI as no more than a week. There's only one race that's allowed to be 10 days long, and they're also limited to only riding 135 kilometres, you know, a day.
Why is that? Why?
Randomness. If women can run a marathon, if women can swim and do triathlon and all of those other sports at the same level, there's no reason. It's just historical. And something like La Course, which is only 89 kilometres, is not going to show off women's cycling. But what Emma Pooley says is that, of course, we couldn't do it from tomorrow. But of course, if we trained for it, we absolutely could. And it's kind of like a weird thing because people talk about it as if it has to be either a full length, full stage Tour de France or this like one day crit, which, you know, is never going to give them the chance to shine. So, you know, why are we not able to have more than one stage? Or, you know, a women's Paris-Roubaix or a women's Paris-Tour or a women's Paris-Nice. You know, there's all sorts of things where you think the ASO who runs it, they could do a lot more.
Is it sexism then, or is it just because there used to be a women's Tour de France? Why is it not happening now?
I think it is sexism. I think it's this idea that's across lots of women's sports that no one's interested in women's sports. And that's what's so wonderful about the current rise in TV and media and online coverage, because we're showing all the time that, oh my goodness, there's definitely an audience out there. And so people like the ASO are pretty much having to run to catch up because they've just been able to dismiss it. Oh, no one's interested. But the internet and social media has shown, given people a voice so people can say, hell yeah, I want to watch this.
Well, I know, Rebecca, you work on women cycling on TV. Are we now showing how it's done in this country, or are we still lagging behind?
I think it depends what sort of level you're looking at, because I work a lot on the domestic scene and also on the Revolution Cycling Series. And, you know, there is no differentiation there in my mind between the male and female fields with something like the Revolution Track Series, because, you know, you're getting a massive pull from the big stars there, like Laura Trott, like Joanna Russell, or like Lizzie Armistead, and Voss has been there as well, as much as you're sort of saying, well, come along and watch Egg Clancy or Peter Kenyuk. So I think, you know, that is a great display. It's gone on Channel 4 this year. And I think, you know, that is showing how it can be. And people, of course, are tuning in and watching. They're not differentiating, as I say. Oh, well, that's the women's race. I'm not interested in that. Of course not. It's brilliant, absolute brutal racing. And, yeah, people are tuning in. I want to see more of it.
And, Sarah, I think we chatted a couple of days ago, and you mentioned the fact there's a real DIY sense of showing women cycling around the world now. That if the major broadcasters are not going to pick up on it, we'll do it ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the USA is a prime example of this. They've had some really interesting ways of doing kind of homemade coverage. And we saw it with the Milt race in Nottingham a couple of weeks ago. They kind of got together, bodged together, and I say that with love, something that we could all watch live on YouTube. And we see it with Cycling Australia's videos and riders making their own videos and teams like Wiggle Honda putting out sometimes the only film that we can see from races. So there really is this thing of, hey, mainstream media, if you watch it, people, if you put it on, people will watch. But if you don't put it on, we're going to do it ourselves.
Well, you mentioned the team there. Let's talk about the teams. For people who don't know, Rebecca, talk me through some of the pro teams that are out there. What are the biggest pro teams, female teams out there?
Well, I think a lot of people recognise what Rochelle Gilmore did with Wiggle Honda. And of course, you know, a lot of the riders that we saw in that have now gone off to separate teams. I think, you know, the fact that we saw the British team pursuit squad in that, all training together in previous years, you know, that really got so much insight into what that team's doing. And as I say, they've all gone elsewhere now, largely. And so we're just picking up, I think, fans for so many women's teams out there. So, yeah, probably... back over to Sarah a little bit, because I know she works with a lot of them and has that inside view.
Well, Sarah, yeah, talk me through. Which are the teams? So we know Wiggle Honda. That's the big team. What else is there?
Wiggle Honda. Well, in the top five, you've got Wiggle Honda. You've then got Bols Dolmans, which is a Dutch-based team with Lizzie Armitstead, Evie Stevens, former ITT world champion Ellen van Dijk, and they're going to be fantastic, one to watch all the time. You've got Orica AIS. They have a men's team. They're Australian-based, but their women's team's major star is Emma Johansson, who is always, always a favourite in every race she starts. Rabolive is the team of current world champion Pauline Fraam-Pavot, an absolute legend, Marianne Vos. They're Dutch-based. They do some really interesting little video too. And the final one of the big five is Velocio SRAM. They're a really international team, but they've been run by Christy Scrimger, who's just phenomenally inspiring herself as well. So those are the big five to watch. And then on the UK scene, Matrix Pro Fitness, which is the home of Laura Trott, and then Pearl Izumi Sports Tours International, which has Sarah Story and Katie Archibald.
So all of these teams have big names.
Oh, yes.
Massive names. And the one thing is, if you follow men's cycling, we'll hear Chris Froome, the big names, Mark Cavendish, and we'll hear million euro contracts. How well funded are these women's teams? Are we talking the same amount of money?
Oh, no. Oh, no. We're talking... I think you can probably say that the biggest teams probably have a... there's maybe two or three that have a budget of over half a million, 600 grand in euros. And but then you kind of drop down very, very quickly. And actually, Velocio SRAM, they lost their sponsor last year and they actually crowdfunded for part of their funding. But if you find out how much these teams are running on, it's really surprising. You know, from the average Bradley Wiggins million pounds a year contract, you could fund a couple of women's teams in that.
Are you surprised that Sky don't have a women's team?
Always. Always. I mean, it's hard because Sky do sponsor all of the national national teams, but we don't have a women's road team at the moment, GB road team. But yeah, by now it's so past being, you know, it's been going on for years that Sky don't have a women's team. So yeah, I mean, it is what it is.
Well, if we're talking about money, maybe now's a good time to introduce Lucy Martin. Now, in 2014, Lucy signed for a UCI-registered team called Estado de Mexico. They were based in Italy. Things didn't go too smoothly, as she wrote about recently in a widely shared blog. Lucy joins us on the phone now from her base in Girona. Good evening, Lucy.
Hello. So nice, I think, to speak to you.
It's nice to speak to you, and I think it's now over to you. Talk us through what happened.
I signed with Estado de Mexico, and I didn't know much about the team before I signed, but because it was a UCI team, and I'd always, for the previous years before that, I'd been in various different teams, I just expected the standard. And the season started off fine, and I did the first couple of months racing with the team, and there was a few issues, but nothing major. And then it basically got to a race in June, and I finished the race, and on the way to the airport, I was basically told by the team manager that I would not be racing again, and that I had my bike to travel home with, and I wasn't allowed to take any training wheels home.
Why were you told this? Why were you told this?
I honestly don't know. At the time, there was no reasoning. It was just out of the blue, and it was basically verbal abuse. I was told I should quit cycling. There's no point in me racing, and he just didn't understand why I was bothering. And so for me to hear this, it was obviously a huge shock, because in the past I've come up with British cycling, which is hugely professional, and this was just the complete opposite. And so from that point onwards, I had hardly any contact with the team, and that was it. I was never allowed to race again, even though I was signed to this team.
But if it's a UCI-registered team, did the UCI help you?
Not really. I had back and forth emails, and at first they were, yeah, very helpful and tried to understand what the situation was, but it definitely didn't seem like a priority. And for me, it was months of just uncertainty. I didn't know what to do. I couldn't leave the team because if I left the team, then I would never race and I would never get paid because that's a breach of contract on my end. But then at the same time, if I stayed on the team and I had a contract, then I couldn't go and race for another team. So from June onwards, I still had the majority of the season left and I was unable to go to any races. And the UCI basically just gave me different people to speak to. And I spoke a lot with their legal advisor, and it was kind of just, oh, we can't really speak to the, we can't contact the Mexican Federation. We're not really having any luck trying to talk to them. And I think I sent like one or two emails a week for months, and nothing came of it really.
So, I mean, I've heard terrible rumours about that team going back years, but obviously riders don't always hear that. I mean, what would have helped you, do you think? And it's fantastic that you're talking out, because then obviously riders aren't going to fall for that in the future. But what would you like?
Yeah, that was a real issue for me, because actually once I'd already signed the contract and started racing, then a few people, and like when I started saying a little bit what had been happening, then that's when a few people were like, oh, I told you so, that team was really bad. And I was kind of like, hold on, I did not know anything. Nobody had spoken out in the past. And even just the year before I signed, there was, I think there was a Swedish girl and a Swiss girl, exactly the same situation, didn't get paid, didn't get raced for a few months. In the end, luckily, I think they did get the money and they were able to race in various ways, but they just kept quiet and didn't do anything. And I think that's the problem. A lot of people are scared to speak out because, you know, that's just how it is. That's just women cycling. That's what they think. And that's, you know, nothing will be done about it. So why would they bother speaking out and also look like they're complaining, moaning about women cycling?
Lucy, and that's, are you worried that people are thinking that's what you're doing right now?
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, last year, it was June last year when I stopped racing and stopped being paid by the team. And I've basically not spoken out really in the press until now. And it was because I really didn't want to come across as just moaning. And I know a lot of people do see women cyclists as just, oh, they're just complaining and it's not the same as the men. And I really want to get rid of this stereotype, because I think, like, I just, in my blog, I try to just state facts and just explain this is the situation, this is how it is. But also there's a lot of good things about women cycling, but this is just a situation that people don't see often. And yeah, basically just try and make people aware of actually what's happening on the negative side of women cycling.
Mm-hmm. So now you're in a very different team. How does it feel this year?
Oh, it's absolutely fantastic. When I go to the races, I'm still shocked because things happen. I ask for something and it happens. And, you know, maybe I'll fly to the race and I'll have to pay for a bike bag myself. And then I'll actually get the money refunded back into my account as an expense. And it's just unbelievable the amount of support I've had. And just to increase my confidence, because after last year, I was really, in various ways, really just not confident with my racing, whether I should be riding anymore, all these kind of thoughts. And Steph Wyman, the team manager, has just, from the start, he's just had confidence and faith in me. And it's always just been a process of, you know, it will come back together. You will be able to race. You can have anything you need now on the team. And that's exactly how it's been. And I cannot thank him enough because of, luckily, and I can imagine a lot of other women in the same situation wouldn't have this opportunity, but luckily I've been given the opportunity to actually stay in the women's peloton and continue racing another full season.
So, Lucy, I think Matrix Pro Cycling have picked up the pieces, but it's a real horror story up to that point of, you know, finding out you've not been paid for so long. If there are budding young cyclists, female cyclists listening to this, or their parents, how worried should they be of the pro world?
It's a difficult one, really, because me coming up as a British cyclist, and I rode for Garmin Cervelo and AA Drinks, and these are really well-established teams. So even I was a bit blind to this side of the women's cycling. I mean, there's a few unprofessional things that can happen, but in the most of the time, I thought it was, you know, it was fine. Everything was perfect. So it was only last year when I just happened to join this Italian team that I saw this side of it. And I think people shouldn't be worried, because it's definitely taken a huge step forward now, but it's just something to be maybe a bit more aware of. Maybe I should have researched the team that I was going to beforehand. But on the other side of things, if it's a UCI team, it should have a standard. and there should also be repercussions if anything goes wrong. So I think also now I've done my blog and people are a bit aware of what can happen, it can only help people coming into the sport.
Well, Lucy, thank you so much for your time. I think you're back off training again tomorrow?
Yep, back in the sunshine.
Jealous. Well, thank you very much. That there is Lucy Martin, who is now riding for Matrix Pro Fitness. We did try to contact the UCI for their rider's reply, but we didn't manage to get hold of them. So the time now is 25 minutes past nine. This is Bespoke Women's Special here with Rebecca Charlton, joins me in the studio, Sarah Connolly and Natalie Justice as well. If you want to get in touch, you can join the conversation 85058 at BBC 5 Live. Now, the corporate side, the commercial aspect of cycling is sometimes as important as the actual riding, and the women's side of sport is totally different to that of the men's. Steve Fry works with cycling rights holders such as the Women's Tour, as well as managing pro riders, both male and female. Steve is on the phone right now. Good evening, Steve.
Hi, OJ.
So explain the differences between men's and women's cycling when it comes to the commercial side of things.
Yeah, it couldn't be more different, to be honest. I mean, you have a scenario where you literally have polar opposites between female cyclists and male cyclists. So just to give you a bit of an example, if you take somebody like Danny King, who obviously we manage, or Laura Trott, then you would be talking about 85-90% of, in effect, what they earn or the income that they generate would come from personal sponsorships. So that's very, very kind corporate entities that see value in them as individuals and choose to invest them, whether that's as brand ambassadors or promoting programs that they do so well around the country. If you then take the flip side of that and look at the male professional cyclist, 80-90% of their income would come from a salary paid for by their trade team. And to give a bit of context into that, the average salary of a male pro rider sort of riding at World Tour level would be in the region of probably £220,000 per
annum. That's the average?
That would be the average, yeah. I mean, and you've got people at the very, very top end that maybe skew that. So somebody like a Peter Sagan, who recently signed a huge contract with Team Cosaxo, he would be on probably somewhere in the region of around €4 million as an annual salary. Now, I know as Sarah's already talked about on the programme today, we then go to the women's pro cycling, and we have a situation where probably out of the 33 teams that are UCI registered, it's probably a majority of female cyclists that don't even get paid, let alone have a salary. And probably the average salary that we have within the women's pro peloton is somewhere in the region of sort of £10,000 to £12,000. So we are talking about two sports that both are fantastic, visually look fantastic from a televisual perspective and from a sponsor's perspective, but currently the investment isn't in the women's side to be able to basically pay them the salaries that they so deserve.
How much money is in the women's side?
Not enough is probably the simple answer to that. I mean, it pretty much lives hand to mouth. I mean, and you've again heard Sarah talk about things about getting women's cycling on TV is basically the panacea that we're all striving for, because the reason there isn't money on the women's side of the sport is that it doesn't have a showcase. It doesn't have enough mainstream and TV especially coverage that warrants then large sponsors coming into the sport, whether that's actually sponsoring a race or whether that's sponsoring teams, to then create a very nice virtuous circle where if there's more money coming into the sport, then obviously that then can flow down to the riders. That then allows riders to be paid salary, that allows them to be able to train full-time, and that then raises the standard of the sport. Not that we're talking about a sport here that is of a low standard anyway, but it does mean to one of the points we were talking about earlier, that if we're going to go and strive for a women's Tour de France, then it means that we can just raise the standard of the whole peloton so that we can have even more competitive racing than we're having already.
Well, on the phone right now is somebody you represent, Danny King, world and Olympic champion and now riding for Wiggle Honda. We've heard lots of views, Danny. From in your eyes, what is women's pro cycling like?
I think it's definitely improved. I did my first pro season with Vision One, Nicole Cook's team, in 2009. And since then, it's just, you know, got better and better, especially in the last couple of years. And I've, you know, enjoyed, I think, a few races that I've done with Wiggle Honda this year. And the level's just going up and up. And I think that's only going to improve as we get sort of the more coverage and potentially sort of the minimum wages. And as Steve's saying there, you know, it will allow the women to be full-time and just raise the bar again. So, yeah, it's definitely on its way up.
Well, you're now a full-time road rider. How different is your life now with what you're being paid? I'm not asking you to tell me how much, but how different is your life now as a full-time road rider to what it was when you were riding on the track as part of Team GB?
Yeah, again, as Steve said, the majority of my income comes from sort of sponsors. I am paid by Wiggle Honda professionally, which is fantastic. Rochelle's done an amazing job there to be able to pay the riders. We've got some fantastic sponsors from the road point sort of side of things. But yeah, it is completely different for the majority of road riders, unfortunately. We've been really lucky with how we've been managed to sort of get sponsors from the track side of things, but it is a lot more difficult for women road riders to get the same.
And if you're looking at young girls who, like yourself, who are just starting, what would you say the best thing is about racing right now?
Oh, that's a good question. It's just such a fantastic sport to be in. You know, there's some great teams out there now, and I just love travelling around with a group of girls who I can genuinely call my friends, who are all striving to be the best in a sport and who've got the same sort of determination. Yeah, to just, you know, be going for specific races, and I can just see, you know, different girls in my team targeting different races, and they're just so passionate about it. And for everyone to just sort of unite to that one goal and just work so hard for someone in a specific race, and then to know that, you know, the next time it comes around, if you're targeting another race, that they're going to sort of leave their legs on the road for you. And I think that's just such a special feeling, and it's just, yeah, it's what I love about professional road riding, the whole team aspect of it. And I guess that's why I love Team Pursuit so much as well on the track, because you're riding together for that specific goal. You've all got the same sort of dream, and you're doing it as a team.
And Danny, final question, is Rio still on?
I hope so, for sure. Yeah, as I've said all along in the media, I am hoping to get back into the Team Pursuit squad for Rio. That is my aim at the moment. And then, yeah, I guess if that wasn't to happen, then I'd be going for the road. So yeah, either way, I hope to be in Rio for sure. That's my dream, that's my aim, and that's what I'm getting on the bike every day, pushing myself to the limit for. So yeah.
Well, Danny King, thank you very much for your time.
No problem. Thank you.
Thank you very much to Steve Fry as well. We've still got loads more coming up with Rebecca Charlton, Sarah Connolly and Natalie Justice as well, all on the way. If you want to get in touch, 85058. Twitter is at BBC5Live.
Bespoke on 5Live.
Welcome back to Bespoke. As that robot said, I'm indeed OJ Borge, and this is our women's special. With me this evening, journalist and presenter Rebecca Charlton, world-renowned women's cycling blogger Sarah Connolly, and British Cycling's Natalie Justice. And if you've only just joined us, worry not, it'll be available as a podcast at the end of the show, where you'll also be able to find the podcast from our special from Tuesday night, all the history of the record, plus our pundits' guesses on whether Bradley Wiggins will break the hour record on Sunday, and there was dissent on what he was capable of. Now, here's a stat for you. 30% of all journeys in Copenhagen are done by bike, and there are more women there cycling than men. Chris Boardman has recently been there to see what they're doing right. He'll be joining us shortly, but next, some truly alarming news headlines from this year.
January the 20th, 29-year-old Stephanie Turner is killed in an accident with a lorry in Stamford Hill, North London. On February the 2nd, music producer Akis Kolaros, who was 34, died after a collision with a lorry in Homerton, East London. 4 days later, 26-year-old fashion designer Federica Baldassa is killed after an accident with a lorry in London's Bloomsbury Square. 19th of February, mother of two, Claire Hittier Abadi, aged 36, killed while riding a Boris bike when she was involved in an accident with a lorry in Victoria. The 9th of April, Moira Gemmell, a prominent figure in the London arts world, died after her bike collided with a lorry near Lambeth Bridge. And just a week ago, on the 28th of May, Esther Hartsilver, a 32-year-old physiotherapist, was critically injured in a collision with a lorry in Camberwell.
Esther Hartsilver were the sixth cyclist to die on London's roads in 2015, all of whom have been women involved in accidents with HGVs. Victoria Hazel is from the cycling charity CTC.
My heart really goes out to those who've lost loved ones in this situation, and it's really why CTC campaigns for things to improve. Every death on the road can be avoided. But I'd just like to say that really the thing that runs through all the names that you've mentioned and all the people that you've talked about is they were involved in a collision with a lorry. And we do know that lorries do pose a risk both to cyclists and pedestrians as well. So the focus really should be on what we can do to improve lorry safety and lorry drivers, not just on cyclists, not just on the victims themselves, because victim blaming in this situation isn't going to help anyone. Sadly, I'm afraid to say, normally in this kind of incident, the cyclist is unable to tell their side of the story. So we can only really go on what the lorry driver tells us in the situation. And things need to change. Things need to be done to make sure that lorries are safe.
All the people that have died in the capital this year on bikes, they're all female names. Why are the female statistics so high?
Well, actually, there isn't a great deal of research to explain why it's women. But there has been some things done. Southbank University, for example, their psychology department, they concluded that women's maybe lack of risk-taking at junctions could be a factor. But as I say, this research is speculation, and really, truly, we don't know why. But what we do know is that women don't cycle as much as men, and that may be putting women off, and it may be that perhaps they're not encouraged to cycle, they're not encouraged to take cycle training, maybe they don't know where to position themselves at a junction. And I know from myself, I've cycled since I was very young. I thought, oh, why would I need cycle training? I've always cycled. But actually going on something like a high-level bike ability has really changed the way I cycle to work. And it's made me take the lane when I'm riding, not ride in the gutter, really think about where I'm going to be at a junction. And quite frankly, when I see a lorry at a junction who's going to be turning, I stay well away because I know that lorry drivers have huge blind spots and I know the statistics.
Does it come down to being too polite? Does it come down to following the rules too much that women are doing? Instead of maybe you could see that some men might be a bit more brusque, they'll just blast through lights, maybe go through red lights. Women are being too polite and putting themselves in a danger area.
I think across the board, without using the gender-specific question, I think there is a lack of education about cycling in the UK. We are not a cycling country. When you look at somewhere like the Netherlands, where people have grown up on bikes, they've been riding since they were small, they have the skills, they're taught at school, they see their mums riding bikes every day. It's just a different culture. And I think we just really need to change things here so that people feel that cycling is not a sport. It is a sport, obviously, but it is a form of transport. And I think when we think about it as transport, we think about learning to drive a car, for example. We need to learn to ride bikes.
Well, this is not me just trying to pick on an agenda totally. It's just the fact that six women have died this year in the capital. There must be something we can do to make it safer for everyone, but specifically for women, if they are getting caught in this sort of situation.
I think it is a cultural barrier. I think that women don't cycle as much as men, but I would say that things like bikeability, making that part of what every school in the whole of the UK does as standard, like you have swimming lessons, it is a life skill to know about the rules of the road. It is a life skill to learn to ride a bike. And I feel that that is something that we could do now to make a massive difference, not just now, but for the future. And we would see road statistics like the unfortunate statistics we're talking about today fall if people had that kind of education.
So in your role as a charity, is that the sort of thing you're looking at doing to get more people full stop, but also to get more women on bikes? Because as soon as I start reading out statistics like the six women to die in the capital this year, surely it's going to start putting people off, isn't it? That becomes a barrier.
It is a massive barrier. And I think people perceive cycling to be a very dangerous thing. And really, when you, let's get it in perspective, you are actually more likely to be injured in an hour of gardening than you are riding a bike. And mile for mile, if you're thinking about going 1 mile to the shops, you could walk there or you could cycle there. Well, the risks actually are virtually the same. But we perceive cycling to be more dangerous. And the reason why we're talking about women in London or the lorry deaths at the moment is because it makes the news, because it is actually rare. We don't talk a lot about people being injured and killed in cars because it is so common. And it doesn't make the news because it's so common.
Victoria Hazel there from the cycling charity CTC. And listening to that is former Olympic champion Chris Boardman, who is now a policy advisor for British Cycling. Good evening, Chris.
Good evening.
Good evening. Now, Chris, I know you've been very proactive on this subject. How concerned are you by this spate of fatalities, predominantly that seem to involve female cyclists in London?
I think it was well covered there, actually. I mean, there's several points I'd like to pick up on. I mean, first of all, I'd agree with that. It makes the news at the moment because it's rare. We don't hear about pedestrians being involved in accidents with traffic because it's not newsworthy. So that perspective bit has been lost, and it's certainly been lost in the last few weeks, which have been frankly ridiculous. So we've got just over 100 deaths a year for cyclists in the UK, which, yes, it's tragic. We have to put that preface there. It is 50,000 deaths related to inactivity, 20,000 from pollution, and on. There's such incredibly big numbers. And it's a safer thing to do as walking, but it doesn't look it and it feel it. And that's the most important thing. To your point about lorries, well, the big bear in the room, or elephant in the room that nobody, I don't know where I got bear from then, elephant in the room that nobody's talking about, is that cyclists and lorries aren't really meant to mix. You know, this fairly high speed traffic and dense traffic and cyclists, it's not ideal, but nobody actually wants to talk about, well, in that case, we have to give somebody priority. So to go on to, you mentioned Copenhagen. Well, what I found there is I could get on a bike and I could wobble and I may not have training, and the other road users look after me.
But why are we not looking after people in this country then? What is it about the British psyche that we're not looking after other road users, other cyclists?
Well, I mean, culture, it's a bit of a get-out clause, but it is a cultural thing, and that takes time and it's painful. So what it starts with, it has to start with a desire, a political desire at the top, and it takes somebody with courage to say, right, this is exactly what happens in the Netherlands in the 70s, because they were going exactly the same direction as us, and they said, right, we don't want to live like this. We are going to prioritise cycling and walking. That's our preferred means of transport. And everything we do, how the streets look, how they work, our laws, everything is going to back that up. So they have, and it's been a big topic at the moment, they have presumed liability, which basically says every road user has a responsibility to look after those more vulnerable than themselves. And that'll be cyclists and pedestrians as well. And it just gives a duty of care. And then it becomes embedded. So I remember riding along the street in Copenhagen, side of the road, and I go start off from some lights. There's a car on my right indicating right. And I'm thinking, oh, it's going to cut across me. And it just waits. And nobody's annoyed. That's normal. It just waits because I have priority as a more vulnerable road user. So I think all of those things that aren't being talked about. Training, absolutely brilliant, great idea. I've got my kids. Bike ability training is fantastic now. But really, it should be secondary. It's not what we need. We're not prioritising the forms of transport at the best for all of us.
Will that happen, though? You're the best person to ask on this. Is that going to happen in this country?
Well, I mentioned culture change. And you've heard it a couple of times, and the two things that it always is slow and painful. There's generally a moment, not a tipping point, where you start to move more in one direction than the other, but it takes a lot of time, and it needs political desire. I mean, David Cameron said he wants to see a cycling revolution. He wants Britain to rival any of our European neighbours. Said that, what, 2-3 years ago now? Well, now he's in a position to deliver it, so let's see if he'll do that.
Well, Chris, stay there for me, please. Now, as we mentioned at the start of the show, what is a bespoke women's special? British Cycling is attempting to get 1 million more women cycling by 2020. Natalie Justice, you're the lady in charge of doing just that. How are we doing right now? How do we get these 1 million more women cycling?
There's lots of different things, really. We did, as you said earlier, we recognised back in 2011 when we launched the Breeze programme, which I'm sure we'll talk about in a little while. But in 2013, we kind of recognised that women's cycling generally was on the decline. It wasn't growing at the rate of men's. We, you know, we've seen a lot of success, so we wanted to do something about it. And that's where we kind of said, you know, we're not scared of ambitious targets. So that's where we said we wanted to get a million more women. And last year, in the first year of it, we managed to get 106,000 women back into cycling or cycling more. you know, which was fab. And like I said earlier, tomorrow we're kind of, we're going to talk about some exciting news and some great news stories.
Can you not tell us now? Go on.
I can't, unfortunately, but people can. We're people can find out, and we're at Regent's Park at 7:30 tomorrow morning, talking about some of that really exciting news, and got lots of things going on there, so people will be able to find that out. But you know, we're really excited to be launching that and to talking about that in Women's Sport Week as well. So, but there's lots of different things that are going on. Breezy is obviously our flagship women's only program, which is all about getting women who maybe don't cycle or haven't cycled for quite a long time onto rides run by other women that we train up as volunteers. But then there's also Go Ride programmes, which is for young girls. And we're doing a lot as well in terms of the entry-level racing as well, which is one of the kind of gaps that we really recognised in terms of women that, you know, talking about what we were doing earlier about the pro side of things, it's really getting that, you know, getting that field of riders a lot bigger. In order to do that, we need to put on the right sides of entry-level racing as well. So there is lots going on. There's lots of exciting stuff. But we do recognise that, you know, there still are some massive gaps, and it's not necessarily just down to British Cycling. It is our partners and everybody that's got you know, a stakeholder in the sport.
Chris, now I know you've recently returned from a trip from Copenhagen. You mentioned it before. You found they've got it really, really right there, haven't they?
Well, I think probably another important point to make here, this has got nothing to do with cyclists. You go to Copenhagen and you see normal people in normal clothes, doing normal things. They dress for the destination, not for the journey. And that's the key difference. We've got a hardy 2% at the moment that just the way it is at the moment, and they take all sorts of precautions and are quite brave in a lot of cases. But what we want is not those people. They've already made a choice, and good luck to them. I am one of them. But what we want is just normal. Recognized, and to make that happen, they've created space for cycling. I mean, be it women, be it men, every road has space built in. The laws protect those people.
Chris, sorry, we're gonna have, the line is just terrible. They're fantastic points, which we'll try and pick up on another time. That is Chris Boardman there. Now, one scheme that Natalie mentioned before is Breeze. Let's hear from some of those women who have given it a go.
Breeze, for me, was the first time I ever got back on a bike since I was a child. Not been on a bike for about 20 years. I went on my first Breeze bike ride, read the description, panicked a little bit thinking, can I cycle 5 miles? And I thought, how ridiculous. Of course you can. You can walk 5 miles, you can cycle it.
You tend to get out more and you do more things, you see more things as you're going around, and it's good because you can bring him along with you, and it's a day out for both of us.
I absolutely love being a Breeze champion. It's great. Fantastic meeting loads and loads of different people and encouraging them to cycle. It's fantastic getting out into the fresh air.
Breeze has definitely made me want to come out more. It's made me want to get involved more in cycling.
It's a really, really fantastic environment, really nurturing. We go at the pace of the slowest rider. We never drop anybody or leave anybody. It's very nurturing, and the leaders are fantastic at really encouraging people to cycle.
That is the Breeze initiative there. Rebecca, I know you've done a lot with Breeze, and you've written about it, haven't you?
Yeah, well, I went out with the Breeze Network for a ride quite recently, actually, and I was just overwhelmed by it. It was just fantastic, you know, and it really struck me that, you know, when I was growing up on a bike, that perhaps wasn't really that available. And no one was too afraid to ask anything. And I was helping out and people were saying, look, I don't know what to do with these pedals. I don't know. I've never, you know, like someone just said there, I've not even ridden 5 miles. And I think one of the problems in the past is that we've probably all been there, especially as women, when someone says, well, you know, go out with that club run or go out with that group of cyclists or head off to that 3-4 cat race, you'll be absolutely fine. And actually, the reality is it's really fast quite a lot of the time and you can feel intimidated. So I think Breeze is just that sort of gateway into cycling for people that is just so non-intimidating. And it really struck me how much friendship was available there as well. And everybody wanted to see each other succeed. No one was getting dropped. No one was sort sort of, you know, pushing the pace and not looking back. It was all a case of regrouping and getting everybody round and loads of smiles and laughs. And it was really, really nice to be a part of.
When you got into cycling, it was because of family, wasn't it? Your dad was into cycling. Do you think, without something like Breeze, back then, if your dad or family hadn't been into cycling, would you have found it?
If I'm really honest, no, because it was my dad's influence. And my whole family, you know, they got me into track racing when I was, you know, really small, about 8 years old. And then when that season ended, I was devastated. So I went and found cyclocross. And again, it was all that influence of my dad and my mum really just driving me to races and making sure they facilitated me getting into it. But yeah, I think I probably wouldn't have found it. And it's really funny to see, you know, Danny King saying earlier how popular the sport is and how much friendship and camaraderie there is in it. You know, for me, when I went to school, it was a weird thing that I didn't talk about. I used to pretend that I didn't cycle because people would be like, oh, you go around that funny wooden velodrome with a pointy hat on. What's that all about? And people just didn't get it. So now, you know, with the role models, with the pathway into it through stuff like Breeze, it's just so much more accessible.
And what Rebecca's saying there, Natalie, is that the point?
I mean, that is exactly what Breeze is all about. It, you know, like with lots of things, and lots of things are cited around, you know, what puts women off, and Breeze is built on a social, it's built on a social network. It's built on the fact that it's an unwritten rule that you probably have a coffee and a cake stop and a chance to have a natter. But it is about the social thing. And in the last 4 years, we've got kind of lifelong friendships and people down the country that, you know, that kind of go on holiday together. And it's just built this kind of network that has built a lot of women's confidence, you know, that maybe would have said previously, you know, that they would never go out on a bike. You know, they wouldn't go 3 miles because they couldn't really kind of understand what that meant in terms of cycling terms. And what obviously Breeze does is build that confidence and does help with the safety aspect as well, because one of the second barriers that women do cite amongst safety is not knowing where to ride. So I think going out with a group of women, like-minded women, with a trained champion, a trained volunteer who, you know, is just doing it because they're so passionate about getting other women riding, is what then builds the confidence, which means they're going to hopefully be riding safer and learn to ride on the roads better, you know, which will have an impact across the board.
So with that initiative, the Breeze initiative, do you ever see us being a Copenhagen? Will we have parity between men and women riding bikes?
I hope so one day. I can't see why not. And to me, you know, progress has been massive in the last few years. And one thing I often say is that at the moment it is great, and in women's sport and everything, progress has really been made, but we can't be complacent. There is still so much to do.
Thank you very much, Natalie. Now, if I said the words "the most successful UK mountain biker ever," you might possibly think I was talking about a man, but I'm not. That accolade goes to Rachel Atherton, and I went to meet her on a wet morning in the Welsh Valleys.
So I'm about to ride this bike that has really weird front tyres. It's got these things and odd-looking handlebars. That's because this is a downhill mountain bike, and I'm about to try that particular sport with the most successful British mountain biker of all time. Oh! Ah! Oh, I'm going off that side.
Yes. Go, go, go!
Ah!
Yeah!
Ah!
Woo!
Tell me about downhill mountain biking. What is it?
Well, that was just a little taster for you. Oh. Imagine doing that for 5 or 6 minutes from the top of Ben Nevis or Fort William in Scotland. I just love the freedom it gives you. You know, when you're riding your bike and it's just you, you're not thinking about anything, you know. There's nothing else in your head apart from where you're going to go, you know, what routes or what rocks or what jumps are coming up.
Well, I can feel the adrenaline wearing off, so let's do a bit more. Put
yeah,
your goggles
let's
on.
Go for it.
Let's get ready to go. Did it! Who got you into doing this sort of ridiculous but exhilarating sport?
Well, my two older brothers got me into racing. I just didn't want to be left alone at home on the weekends. For me, racing is what I love, and I want to help more girls kind of find that passion. So I just kind of want to be there for them, and, you know, so they can enter the races and know they've got some support. You know, the sport's grown massively in the last 5 years. You go to any trail centre and, you know, women are everywhere.
So you're trying to get more women involved, and you're actually sponsoring a series now, aren't you?
Yeah, the British Downhill Series, the junior women's category. I think just for me, it's really important to kind of, you know, get more girls into racing. You know, a lot of women are starting to ride, but the racing side of it is what I want to see, you know, grow. And, you know, being at a race, it might be quite a daunting prospect. So for them to think, you know, I can go and talk to Rachel or get some advice on lines or, you know, track walk together, that's just something that, you know, is really important to me.
Is it dangerous?
I once hit a dog's food bowl that had rolled out from the side of the track. But that, you know, you can get injured doing anything, and I think most people would rather suffer a few injuries and have the rest of the time, you know, enjoying themselves and really kind of been out there and experiencing it. So, you know, as with anything, it's going to be a bit dangerous, and there's definitely times when you're going to be in a pile on the floor.
So you've been so successful, you've won so many titles. Is there any point where you think, I'd like to win an Olympic gold, that's what I want to do?
The dreaded question. Yeah, definitely. For me, the Olympic dream is one I've had since I was a real little kid. And it's, you know, it's always there in the background. One thing I'm super excited about is the track, you know, the velodrome. And I've done a couple of test events and I've done a bit of riding on it. And, you know, that's one thing that I could do, and I could switch to track. But riding around the velodrome compared to riding around the mountains, it's a lot different. And I'm not sure, you know, just the sheer excitement I think I'd miss of riding my mountain bike. But yeah, going on the track and switching to that is definitely something that interests me and might be for me in the future, so we'll see. Ready?
No.
Put your hands on.
All right, go on then.
Let's go. Come on! Woo!
And that's a puddle. And now my ankles are wet. And that's... Ah! And that's a big rock! Ow!
Yeah.
And that's another pedal. And that's another rock. And that's some stairs. Well, that was faintly ridiculous.
That's the bottom of the track.
Yeah? What do we do now?
Well, should we do it again? Go back to the top?
Do we have to?
Yeah, back to the top. We can get a lift, though.
Can we?
Yeah, because this is mountain biking. We drive up, ride down.
Oh, OK. I hate cycling up hills anyway.
And if you want to see that in moving pictures as well as just listening to it, Bespoke now has a TV show which you can find on the iPlayer alongside me attempting the hour record, which was pure pain. Warning, there is a sweaty me involved in that, and riding the Fred. You can find Bespoke TV on the iPlayer. And if you want to see Rachel Atherton, who I was riding with there in the Welsh Valleys, Sarah, where can we see her?
Well, she's going to be racing in Fort William this weekend on Saturday and Sunday. And on Sunday, the Fort William World Cup downhill finals are going to be shown live on Red Bull TV, which is fantastic. And if you want to know more about her, follow her social media, because she's one of the most incredible personalities. You will not regret it.
A really, really quick answer on this, Sarah. She really does market herself well. Do women cyclists need to look at someone like Rachel Atherton and look at how she puts herself out there?
Oh, absolutely. And there is so many examples of people doing this already. BMX, Caroline Buchanan, riders like Valentina Scandolara, who has the most random but fantastic YouTube videos. But yeah, this is the future. People like Helen Wyman, Rachel Atherton, they're showing us how to do it.
So we've come to the end of this Bespoke Women special. I'd like to end on this text, actually, and I'd like to get a response from all of our guests. It comes in from No Name. It says, my partner has tried riding a bike with me but complains of pain to her lady parts. Any advice you can offer Rebecca?
Yeah, I mean, that's really common. The first thing I'd say, and this sounds really, really obvious, is I hope you're not wearing knickers with the cycling shorts, because a lot of people would do that. They'd think it was normal. But obviously the chamois is designed to be next to your skin, so make sure, first of all, you ditch the knickers. Maybe some chamois cream, antibacterial, and always a clean pair of shorts every time you go out.
Sarah?
Get a good saddle and go through it. It will get better, I promise you.
And Natalie, we don't have time to ask you, unfortunately, but thank you very much to all my guests this evening. Thank you very much to Natalie Justice, to Sarah Connolly and Rebecca Charlton. You can hear this as a podcast if you're just catching it now on the 5 Live website, and you can find the Hour Record one there as well.
On digital and online.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
bbc.co.uk/5Live.